My guest is Pascal Lamy. Pascal Lamy served two consecutive terms as Director General of the World Trade Organization, WTO, from 2005 to 2013. Before that, he was a European Commissioner for Trade and the European Commission in Brussels. And from the mid-80s to the mid-90s, he was the chef de cabinet of Jacques Delors when Jacques Delors was president of the European Commission. Now he's the vice president of the Paris Peace Forum, and he coordinates the Jacques Delors Institutes in Paris, Berlin, and Brussels. Welcome to the podcast, Pascal.
Glad to be with you.
Right, we're going to jump right in, okay? Tariffs, the impact of the Trump administration on the new world trade order. A lot of, as you know, comment and analysis of the tensions, but certainly the media, has been on tariffs themselves. The level of tariffs, the timing of tariffs, the sectors affected, the countries affected. And maybe not enough analysis is spent on the broader implications of that. So that's why I was very keen to talk to you now, Pascal, beyond the details of the nitty-gritty of whatever tariff Mr. Trump at the White House chooses to announce and then change his mind maybe the next day. In your judgment, the impact of the new White House administration on the World Trade Order?
Well, I think you're right to consider that Trump tariffs are only one part of this evolving world trade landscape. The backstage discussion is about globalization.
Right.
Whether or not we've reached a stage of globalization which is plateauing or regressing or which will keep moving forward. And I think this is the big question, and there are various views. My own view, for what it's worth, is that given the shaping factors of the previous period of globalization, i.e. trade-wise, a multi-localization of production systems, which is favored, boosted by eliminating tariffs or other restrictions, my own view, for what it's worth, is that given the infrastructure of globalization, globalization will keep moving.
Okay.
I don't believe it will move back. It may be plateauing. What's for sure is that it's morphing. It's not the same globalization as the one we had before. And the reason why it's morphing is, if you look back at human history, it's always been morphing as the cost of distance and relative prices have evolved. So those are the ingredients of the changes in globalization, and whether you take the Middle Ages or internet or aviation, it's the same. Now, this being said, the US intervention in trade, and we know, and we've known for a long time that Mr. Trump is a big believer in tariffs as a major tool of economic policy, which may seem strange, I mean, in the 21st century. I mean, it was a major tool of economic policy in the Middle Ages or in islands. It had vanished a lot since the last 30 or 40 years, but there he is, and he believes that tariffs is the way to make America great again. And this will not change.
Right.
He might adjust his tariff posture a way or another, depending on what will be the negative impact of tariffs on the US economy and the political repercussions of that, maybe. Mm-hmm. And it's still very unclear where we are at this stage, but his act of faith will not change. Now, is this a revolution in world trade? No. The US is 13%, 13% of world imports. If the remaining 87% keep their head cool and refuse to be contaminated by this protectionist folly, the US will be a sort of outlier. There'll be roughly 90% of world trade, which will still be governed by the rules of WTO, which will still evolve as it did in reducing obstacle to trade and as a function of relative prices. But there will be, let's say, 10%, assuming the 13 becomes 10 because of tariffs, which will reduce the footprint of US on world trade. I don't think this is a revolution. So I disagree with the doctrine which the US are now disseminating, that they are the head, the leading group of an ongoing revolution on world trade. I don't agree with that, and I don't think we should accept this doctrine. And as often part of the politics, including geopolitics, including geoeconomics, is driven by narratives.
To give us some perspective, so you say globalization, as we still kind of tend to refer to it, is maybe not in retreat, it may be stagnating briefly or morphing. But again, to give some perspective, before Trump entered the White House, the United States was showing clear signs of some kind of protectionist tendency, surely. What kind of path has it been on since he came to the White House, as opposed to what was happening before?
No, you're absolutely correct. Trump's tariffs faith matches a view in the US that globalization has gone too far and has damaged the US society and notably blue collars who were in, let's say, the traditional industry which has been globalized. That's a political reality, and clearly Trump surfed on that. And by the way, the Biden administration, which followed Trump's first mandate, was in the same sort of line of thought.
Right.
The doctrine of the Biden trade administration was, we have to make this work for workers, farmers and family better than it did. There is a deep truth behind this. And those who know me know that I've been saying for the last 35 years that globalization is efficient and painful. And it is efficient because it is painful, and it is painful because it is efficient. It works according to economic theory, sort of Ricardo Schumpeterian simple formula. You do something better than I do something better than you do. We have a rational interest to trade. But of course, what Schumpeter says is that the people on your side who do things less well than I do will have a problem, and the other way around. That's, I think, the reality, both according to economic theory and what happened if you look, for instance, at the waves that followed China's accession to the World Trade Organization at the beginning of the year 2000. This is a reality which I've always said we have to recognize better. It's both. Unsurprisingly, the impact of globalization has been felt more or less by social tissues, by production systems, depending on the capacity of public policies to buffer the damage which it creates. And unsurprisingly, if you look at where the US is in the league table of the welfare states, given their extremely high relative GNP per head, the US are not where they should be, according to the theory, the collectivity, the state, has to deal with this distributional problem. Winners, losers. Losers have to be understood, listened to, roughly in Europe, and which doesn't mean that everything is fine in Europe. We have the capacity to do that. And by the way, if you look at where public opinion is the most pro-trade, it's where social systems are the largest.
Right.
The US, which has a very thin social insecurity reduction system. If you look at how much they spend on welfare, it's absolutely clear. They, in a way, paid the price of the absence of a proper welfare system. And this political price is extremely high. It's Trump and others. And that's a big price to pay.
Right. I want to come on in a moment to the specifics of the so-called EU-US trade deal. But before we do that, what is the lasting impact of this Trump doctrine, if we can call it that? To what extent will it outlast his term of office in the White House?
I think it's a bit too soon to say. Depends very much how the remaining 90% will behave. Now, so far, they have not behaved collectively. They've accepted to enter into bilateral trade negotiations with the US, which in my view is a systemic mistake. But there are various reasons to that, and we might come back to that in the discussion. But on the other hand, we haven't had a sort of ripple effect of what Trump does into other bilateral trade relations. So we are somewhere in the middle of the possible impact. My guess, for what it's worth, is that the fact that many countries will lose market share in the US, not a lot, but some, and this is the richest and the largest market for using your comparative advantage, this will translate into a diversification of the trade relations of the remaining 90% among themselves. So there will be a loss of, in a way, trade volume with the US, but there will be a win of trade volumes elsewhere. How much will be the balance? I don't know, but I think that's the way to go. And by the way, obviously, this is the road which the European Union has started to walk into.
Right. On that one, the so-called EU-US trade deal, I quote you the statement, part of the statement put out by the European Commission at the end of August, quote, "This framework agreement represents a concrete demonstration of our commitment to fair, balanced and mutually beneficial trade and investment. This framework agreement will put our trade and investment relationship, one of the largest in the world, on a solid footing and will reinvigorate our economy's reindustrialization." So is this deal fair, balanced and mutually beneficial as far as you are concerned, Pascal?
No. And I've written my opinion on that a few days after the Tambury Accord, which was published on the Jacques Delors Institute's website. I think this rationale to explain the deal is wrong. Not that there is not a rationale behind the deal, but it's a different one. And this is where I have criticized the European Commission. Not so much on the result, which is unfair. 15% on the one side, zero on the other side is clearly unfair. But which, in my view, is the price to pay to keep the US engaged in Ukraine. So this is not a trade deal. This is a geostrategic deal. As Mr. Trump has decided, contrary to all his predecessors, not just to weaponize trade, but to merchandise security, we Europeans need the US on board with Ukraine against Russia for the time to go. This is essential for us. This is existential for us. If a 15% tariff is the price, the damage to pay for that, although I do recognize that there is no guarantee in this deal that the US will keep helping Ukraine as it needs to be done, then you have the right picture. And I am of the view that if this is the price to pay to maintain the US support for Ukraine, this is worth the deal. But I also agree that the body language of this agreement was terrible. If you are the average European, I know you've been told many times that EU is the thing that will protect us and we have a solidarity and we are stronger together. And there's an area where we are very strong, which is trade, because we have the largest and deepest market in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, this is in total contradiction. So I think the communication, the body language, the political packaging of this, Madame von der Leyen going as far during the press briefing she gave in February as saying that she understood the US had a problem with their trade deficit, which they don't. If you look at goods and services, the US don't have a trade deficit problem with the European Union. So indulging in going as far as that in the recognition that the narrative of the other side is right, I think was wrong. But she had probably good reasons not to insert this into a larger geostrategic picture. Although when she speaks on these issues and she considers publicly that Russian planes who penetrate into NATO air territory, shooting them is an option. I mean, that's not exactly the EU Commission competence.
Yeah.
So the communication was politically horrible. The substance, I think, can be argued.
You said a couple of times now that Ms. von der Leyen criticised, the European Commission has criticised, but it's hardly a secret that to a large extent she was doing what member states, certainly certain large member states, were allowing her or telling her to do. She didn't act in total isolation or totally autonomously, did she?
That's absolutely correct. On the trade side, she had good reasons to accept not to use the retaliation armory which the EU have when threatened or coerced by foreign power. We have in the EU, and I know that from the time I was EU Trade Commissioner, at the time I had a pistol, now they have a cannon. So it's very different. In the meantime, the EU has been muscling its own trade defense instrument. There was a possibility to say to the US, if you do that, we will retaliate. You're absolutely correct, and she's absolutely correct in saying that you needed a majority of member states, roughly, to do that, and there was not that majority, including, by the way, from member states who then criticized the deal, whereas they were not very much in favor of shooting on the US. So, again, that side of the deal, I totally understand. And again, I'm not criticizing the deal itself, given the context. What I'm criticizing is the way this has been scenarized. And in politics, scenery matters a lot, as asked Mr. Trump.
Right. Maybe explain something to me. I'm the non-expert here, Pascal. You are the expert. The part of the deal which stipulates that European companies are expected to invest an additional $600 billion across strategic sectors in the US between now and 2028. How exceptional an item is that in any kind of trade deal? Of course, other parts of the globe also are expected to invest in the United States economy, Japan, South Korea, the Gulf States. And to quote Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, in essence, other countries are providing us with a sovereign wealth fund. Is it such a striking new phenomenon, this pledge to invest such a huge amount of money?
Well, that's the way Trump sees trade and investment issues. For him, there is no win-win. It's a zero-sum game. And if you want to sell on the US market, you pay the tariff and you take commitments to invest into the US market. Now, as you rightly said, the language of this accord is that they are expected, whatever that means. And this is, by the way, a clear difference with, for instance, the deal that Japan cut with the US, where not only do they accept that they are expected to invest in the US, but in the US-Japan deal, it's the US who decide where this investment should go,
right,
which is really weird. I'm pretty sure that these things will not happen this way. But what it says is that the US, and they are not the only one on this planet, are now, for national security reasons, whatever that means, and the scope of what it means can be very large, are interfering with trade and investment more than before, and this is explained by the growing geopolitical tensions which we've had, the background of this being the US-China rivalry. But of course, when you look at what happened when Russia invaded Ukraine or when Israel invaded Gaza, you understand that we are in a totally different world than the one we were in 20 or 30 years ago, and suffice it to say, not for the better.
Right. We are actually running out of time, but I'm conscious of spending a lot of time until now, Pascal, only asking you about the United States. Let's bring China into the picture briefly. To what extent do you subscribe to this relatively new theory of what's called weaponized interdependence? These two large blocks, two large economies, the United States and China, have in effect chokeholds on the economies of the rest of the world, and they can restrict access to capital and to raw materials and all the rest, as well as, of course, trade and tariffs and stuff. And how vulnerable is Europe in that particular context?
That's a very good question. What hasn't changed is the cost benefits of interdependence. What has changed is that 20 years ago, the benefits of interdependence were seen as higher than the cost. Now, the costs are seen in some cases higher than benefits. And what has changed is not the equation. The elements of the cost and benefit analysis are the same. It's the context. Mm-hmm. The moment geopolitics start trumping geoeconomics, after a period where, let's say, after the fall of the Berlin Wall and until the arrival of Xi Jinping, let's say, in China, geoeconomics had been seen as trumping geopolitics, the context has changed. So the balance has changed, and we now have to be much more attentive to the possible negative impact of this interdependence. And rare earth is a very good example of that. And you know, it's no secret that China has been building a sort of, if not monopoly, at least a very, very large dominant position in a sector which is absolutely crucial in the decarbonation of our economies. It's what has changed is the lens with which we see the world.
As a final question, Pascal, I'd like to switch gear a bit and maybe take you a bit by surprise. We're not going to talk about trade in this last question. You mentioned a couple of times Ursula von der Leyen, and I want to ask you about the way she runs as president of the European Commission. She's now into her second term. As I mentioned in the introduction, you were the chief of staff, a very young chief of staff, chef de cabinet of Jacques Delors when he was president back in the 80s. Do you see any parallels between the way Ursula von der Leyen runs the European Commission and Jacques Delors does, and also her entourage? You were, by all accounts, a pretty intimidating chef de cabinet all those years ago. Do you see any comparisons in how her chef de cabinet operates than you did all those years ago?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to indulge into what the Latins call the laudator temporis acti, which is that, it was so
in my day.
Great in my day. No way. The reality is that the world has formidably changed.
Yeah.
And that the EU is now struggling against large political, economic forces. It's lagging behind in its growth potential, which was not the case at the times of Delors, who could, with the internal market, increase this growth potential quite significantly. Mm. It's under ideological threat from outside because of attacks against democracy, and Trump and Putin are doing that. And that's a big change.
Right.
I mean, Delors, Spain would join the European Union because it had become a democratic country.
Right.
And that it was even true for Greece in the 80s.
Yeah.
So you had a bunch of strong political leaders to cope with within the Union. Mitterrand, Kohl, Lubbers, Andreotti, González, just to name a few. And I could give you a much longer list. Yeah. I mean, the slate of people able to deal with you was totally different. Mm. So you cannot compare.
Right.
What I think von der Leyen has been doing reasonably well is reacting to these external damaging forces. COVID was, I think, a good example of that. Mm. The invasion of Ukraine is a good example of that. So, in a world where the EU is surrounded by threats, if you take them one by one, I think she's been reasonably good at driving this, although, and that's my own view, in a way to run the Commission, which is in many ways hyper-centralized. We have to remember that the Commission is a college, and that listening to views of people who may not think the same way as you do because they come from a different country, a different culture, or different religion, or different tradition. This diversity is an asset of the way the Commission cooks its proposals. I think this has been lost too much. Although I also recognize that moving to one commissioner per member state with 27 member states creates a situation where the average quality, so to say, of commissioners is inevitably lower than in the previous system. So to finish answering your question, I think where von der Leyen should work better is to provide a vision of how the Commission sees EU in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. Mm-hmm. The counterpart of the huge institutional leverage which the Treaty of Rome gave to the Commission to drive Europe in the direction of what the Commission believes is the EU general interest, and notably this little secret that in many areas you cannot change a proposal of the Commission without the assent of the Commission, but with unanimity, which is a formidable institutional leverage. The counterpart for that is that the Commission has to be seen in the driving seat of not deciding, but designing the future of Europe. And this is where I think she's not doing as well as she should.
Okay, well, we have to leave it there. Pascal Annie, thank you very much for your time.